Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In all of the provocations the U.S. has confronted with Vladimir Putin's Russia, in Ukraine, Georgia, Syria, Iran, to just name a few, an overriding policy end has been the avoidance of a wider conflict, while simultaneously confronting Russian actions. My guest today says that that conflict, though, is largely already underway, with disinformation, cyber attacks, clandestine and outright support for America's adversaries, and weaponizing international business. Even Putin himself, an ex-KGB officer, refers to these actions as hybrid warfare. Today we hear from a veteran CIA officer with 28 years' experience in the CIA's National Clandestine Service. In that career, John Cipher confronted Russian intelligence over a number of years as chief or deputy chief of station in Europe, Asia, and other high-threat environments. At retirement, he was a member of the CIA's Senior Intelligence Service, the leadership that guides CIA activities. Currently, he's a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and a co-founder of Spycraft Entertainment, a production company providing content to the entertainment industry. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, speaking on Putin's war against the United States. He's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. John Cipher, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure. Wonderful to be here.
I just want to ask you about, in the past couple of weeks, there have been two major provocative moves on Russia's western border. The first involves Belarus and Poland. We've seen major mobilizations on Poland's eastern frontier. And Belarus is basically encouraging migrants to come over the border into Poland and, by extension, the EU. And recently, tensions really ratcheted up when Russia decided to have paratroopers jump into Belarus. What's going on there?
If I knew exactly what was going on, I think they'd rehire me back into government. But what's likely is, you know, Vladimir Putin's been involved in this sort of long-term hybrid warfare or political warfare against the West and certainly against the United States. And one of the things he has that he can always sort of ratchet up tensions or ratchet down tensions depending on whether he needs more attention or he's upset with the United States or the West. And we even saw this, I think it was maybe 6 months ago or so, where he all of a sudden, you know, lots of troops moved towards the border with Ukraine, and Biden government had to sort of get involved and push back, and there was nervousness that they might send troops in or reinvade Ukraine, and then he soon seemed to back down. And now I think we're seeing some of that again on the Russia side. And, you know, this is the kind of thing he can sort of pull out at any time he wants to sort of raise pressure and get some attention. And then, of course, with Belarus, this is sort of a longstanding thing. Lukashenko has been essentially the dictator there and is almost proud of that term, you know, since the early to mid-90s. And I can remember years ago, even when I was served in that part of the world, you know, he shot down sports balloonists who happened to happened to float into Belarus. They took MiG fighters and shot him down and killed these sport balloonists.
Oh, wow.
And ever since that time, he's continued to be provocative. And at certain points, he wanted to sort of move away from Putin and Russia. And other times, he's wanted to move closer. And there was an election, as you recall, a year or so ago, which he likely lost, but of course cheated and made it clear that he won. And since that time, he's been cracking down domestically. A number of, you know, senior politicians and officials have had to flee the country. And he's had to move closer to Putin to sort of, he thinks, to protect himself against the West or to use Russia's strength so that he can get his way. And he's started to use these refugee flows almost as a weapon. And so there's a number of these unusual sort of weapons, whether it's disinformation or fake news or all these other kind of things. But now Lukashenko in Belarus has found this sort of new weapon. It's using refugees as a weapon. And as you recall, in recent years, the refugee flows from Syria and Afghanistan, these places, have caused, you know, serious political problems in Europe, just like how immigration in the United States can cause political frictions and be used by one party against the other. It's being used there, and he seems to have taken the next step and actually encourages refugees to come in, which he then buses and moves to one of the borders.
And gives them wire cutters.
Yeah, gives them wire cutters. And then pushes them into either Lithuania or Poland, yeah, creating a series of problems, which then forces people to have to try to deal with him. So it's a very sort of dicey and dangerous situation that's happening there.
And right there on the border, you know, Poland is mobilized, so they're not letting these migrants come in. So you have a humanitarian problem. I want to talk a little bit about Lukashenko, because Lukashenko is, I mean, Russia seems exasperated by him at times. You know, he's a loose cannon.
I think that's right. And you know, the people who study that, I don't think Putin likes Lukashenko. And, you know, he's caused problems. And early on, Lukashenko sort of wanted to move Belarus closer to Russia and maybe almost be, you know, even sort of be taken by Russia. And then at other times, he's tried to sort of push away and push towards the West. And so he would use that as sort of a tool to sort of push back against Putin. So if he wanted to go against Putin, he'd claim he wanted to move closer to the West. And then when he had a problem with the West, he'd push closer to Putin. And so I think at this point, yeah, Putin may not like him personally, but since Lukashenko is antagonizing the West so much, it's in Putin's interest now to sort of support that and foment that and use it as a weapon as he can. It doesn't mean in the future he won't find a way to pull away from him.
No, although Lukashenko made a statement about he had the ability to cut off Russian natural gas to the West, and Putin basically had to get up the next day and say, no, we stand by our contracts with Western countries, and we're not going to do that. I mean, that's kind of the...
Well, like I said, Lukashenko is one of these sort of last dictators. You know, he was, I think, a tractor salesman or something before he became the leader of Belarus, and he's had to use pretty, you know, hard tactics against the opposition there and dissidents in Belarus. And so he's sort of a dictator now, and there's times when he causes trouble for Putin, and there's other times where Putin sort of wants to use him.
Earlier, you were talking about, you know, how Belarus will move closer to Russia and then move away. There are a lot of foreign policy observers that say this relationship is moving closer and Russia would like nothing more than to reabsorb Belarus. Do you believe that, or do you think there's still enough differences there that Russia would just like to have major influence over Belarus?
Yeah, it's changed over time. And I mean, Belarus, to give an example of what Belarus is like, they are still the only country that's kept the name KGB for their security service. So the Belarusian KGB are their security service. And so that's a thing that can change sort of what Putin's needs happen to be. So as you know, Putin has taken the Crimea and Ukraine and has sort of a low-level war going on in eastern Ukraine, which can benefit him politically, but sometimes can hurt him economically. So them bringing Crimea into the fold has been an outflow of cash to try to deal with that problem. And whereas, you know, culturally they're very close and there might be reasons why, you know, from the outside you think if they move together that's going to strengthen them, you know, I think Putin sometimes realizes that could actually be a draw economically, as he has the need to pay Belarusian pensions and, you know, put money in from the Russian coffers into Belarus to keep it strong and militarily. So it's not clear to me that that's something that people talk about. I don't think it benefits Putin at this point to try to pull them together.
Yeah,
and of course, they both have egos too, right? So, you know, someone like Lukashenko doesn't want to be part of another country necessarily when he's the kingpin in Belarus.
Yeah. I was going to also say, from the last election, it would say there's a definite majority of the population that doesn't want Lukashenko. Whether they also want Russia or not, that's an open question as well.
That's right. And what's been interesting about sort of the, I don't know what the right term is, the opposition or dissidents or people in Belarus, I say Belarus. It's white Russia in Russian.
Yes, right. Yeah.
They were very clever to make it clear they don't like Lukashenko and voted against Lukashenko, but they've been also very careful not to be anti-Russian or to try to make it look like what we saw in Ukraine, whereas Ukraine, when they voted and pushed away, they wanted to move clearly away from Russia in the Russian orbit and move to the West. And I think Belarusian citizens have sort of learned that, hey, you know, we don't like Lukashenko. We want our votes to count. But that doesn't mean we're trying to antagonize our Russian neighbors or any of our neighbors for that matter. You know, we don't necessarily need to be part of NATO or part of the EU, but we need to solve this problem of having this dictator who is, you know, keeping our economy down and keeping our political freedoms down.
Well, let's talk about the second major provocative movement in the last couple of weeks, and that was a dispute in a contested village between Ukrainian and Russian-backed separatists, which led to shelling from those separatists and a response with the Ukrainian drone strike, which in turn brought Russia right in. You know, they scrambled jets, they massed forces again at the border, and it seemed like we had, again, this potential tinderbox situation.
You know, and from my opinion, you can see this as something that Putin can use to his advantage, and sort of it's clever how they can blame Ukrainians for defending themselves, right? And so they have troops there, and they've been pushing and have sort of a ongoing sort of slowly burning war in eastern Ukraine, and all of us, and Putin has made it clear he doesn't want Western or U.S. weapons to be used, or they doesn't want that to be pushed up. He's saying this is sort of my sphere of influence, don't mess with it. And so when the Ukrainians have sort of stepped up to push back, the Russians are threatening and pushing and bringing troops to the, and making it clear that, you know, they don't take this well. But for a moment of the school that, you know, the Russians are the ones that have caused the problem. They're the ones that started it. They put their foot on the neck, and when the other person pushes back, they say, oh my God, this is terrible. They're, but, you know, it's Ukrainian land, and they're defending themselves. And so I think and hope that we in the United States and in the EU and NATO will support the Ukrainians on this one.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Putin's administration has come out with statements that sound very similar to what China is saying about Taiwan.
Yeah.
I mean, not recognizing the legitimacy of the government, and also sort of making this sort of statement that Ukraine is only exists because of the mistakes in the 1990s, and that really Ukrainian and Russian interests are, you know, so closely intertwined. That seems like this is going to be a tension point for a long time.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, culturally and for a long time, I think Putin and Russians in general, you know, saw the Ukraine as sort of a smaller version of Russia. You know, the Kiev and Rus is where Russia sort of began. There's these historical connections. It's almost like Kosovo for Serbia, if you follow that part of the world. And Taiwan's a good example, too. In China, I think, you know, as unfair as that looks to us in the West, it's taken really seriously by Beijing and the Chinese. And the same with Putin. I think he really believes that, you know, Ukraine shouldn't exist except to be part of Russia or to be close to them. And he grew up in a state where it was part of the Soviet Union, you know, a smaller brother, if you will. But frankly, this is a problem that he has exacerbated and made worse in recent years. If there was some vestiges of Ukrainian population that wanted to be closer to Russia or not be as close to the West, by taking Crimea and then invading eastern Ukraine, he is essentially guaranteed that Ukraine sees its future with the West. Whereas it might have been an open question 10 years ago, the majority of Ukrainian citizens outside of the places that have been taken over by the Russians, you know, they see the Russians now as invaders. They see the Russians as, you know, people who are willing to kill Ukrainian citizens, and they see their future with the West. And so I think Putin has sort of guaranteed that Ukraine is no longer going to want to ally itself and push itself with the East and with Russia. And so, yes, it's frustrating for him. Yes, I think he has these views, these sort of cultural views, that are old-fashioned views. But, you know, he's made it worse. He's made it less likely that that is going to become part of the Russian sphere in the future.
It's kind of interesting. You know, I've grew up with, you know, Cold War rhetoric. And I've always felt like, you know, Russia sees Ukraine as, you know, just cousins in arms. Ukrainians have kind of felt differently.
Very true. And, you know, Ukrainian history is actually quite unfortunate in many ways. I mean, in the Soviet days, the famine and the amount of deaths there
and the pogroms,
you know, some of the Soviet troops and others have had to use pretty brutal methods in Ukraine sometimes.
It's so, the breadbasket, and it was collectivized. And,
and there
untold millions died.
Yep, there's some Ukrainians in the past that, you know, were anti-Moscow, anti-Soviet, or pushed with the West. And as Putin took over in the early 2000s and afterwards, you know, there was movement in Ukraine whether to move to the West or stay closer to the East. And, it, you know, it certainly angered Putin, and he used his power to try to stop what he thought was inevitable movement to the West. And, you know, he may have stopped it temporarily, but now he's created sort of a generation of people who want nothing to do with Russia.
My guest today is John Cypher. He's a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and a 28-year veteran of the CIA National Clandestine Service. He was a guest speaker for the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, speaking on Putin's war against the U.S. And that war is something that Putin refers to as hybrid warfare. What do we mean by hybrid warfare?
Well, it's interesting. So it's a form, I would say, of another term, sort of asymmetric warfare, almost like terrorism, right? So if you're a smaller group, terrorist group, or you're facing a massive NATO or Western or American army or American power, economic power, you can't take it on head on. So what you need to do is sort of change the circumstances. If you've decided that those are your enemy and you're going to try to weaken them, you have to look for weak spots. You have to find other ways to deal with things to push back. And frankly, this has been a part of Russian and Soviet power projection for years and years. In fact, that's one of the things I'm going to be talking about, is sort of the history here and why what's happening today is very, very reminiscent of what happened since the early Bolshevik days when they created a security service who saw themselves as, you know, weak in Europe in those early years and had to find ways to sort of weaken their enemies from within, right? They couldn't take them on head on, and so they would use disinformation and assassinations and spy things and conspiracy and sabotage and all these type of things that, you know, we've actually now seen in the United States for the last 4 or 5 years from Russia. And so it's asymmetric warfare. It's the warfare of the weak against the strong. It's political warfare in the sense it's like trying to weaken an enemy without having a kinetic, you know, actual war that in the way we see it fighting. But it's a way of sort of demoralizing and weakening your enemy so that if ever something does move in that direction, you may have controlled the circumstances to your advantage. And so we saw some of it, you know, in 2016, messing with our elections, trying to use political anger and tribal anger in the United States against each other, try to foment anger, try to turn Republicans against Democrats. It's using disinformation, sabotage, and to include assassination. There's been a number of, you know, in Europe, for example, where they've assassinated people who they thought were, you know, trouble for them in
dissidents,
Russia.
Yeah.
Dissidents,
yeah.
And even inside the country, you know, Navalny and others like that, where they tried to murder him. And so this is something they've used forever. Vladimir Putin is a career KGB officer. He grew up using these tools, and he continues to use them against us and the West.
When you talk about sabotage, in 21st century parlance, that's oftentimes internet attacks, and they seem to be doing this, or at least they say there are people, the attacks are originating from Russia, whether they're sanctioned or not. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously Russia says they aren't sanctioned, but they seem to keep happening.
Well, they definitely keep happening. And let me give you an example. During the Cold War, the Soviet Union and the KGB created a false story that the United States created the AIDS crisis. They said the Pentagon in their laboratories had created AIDS as a weapon to be used against third world countries and black African countries and these type of things. It's a fake story. They put it in a newspaper in India. They then tried to put it into other newspapers. They had some of their sources around the world, you know, scientists, you know, claimed that this was true. And over a period of 3 or 4 years, this story sort of grew and grew, and they used it and pushed it and fomented so much that after a few years, it was a story that was actually even resonating in the United States. It was on the national news, the CBS Evening News, saying, hey, there's a story that the AIDS crisis may have come from a Pentagon lab. This was a KGB-created false story that made its way into the West. Now, what they've done in recent years, of course, with social media, you no longer have to put it in a paper in India and move it along the media food
chain.
That's
a good place for it to die these days.
Yeah, you can pump it into social media. Trolls and bots can then take this information and push it. So they can create false stories, or they can take real stories and twist them and push them forward. But frankly, in the recent years after the 2016 election, they don't even need to do that so much. They can just monitor us attacking each other. They can take Americans and others that are just, you know, vehemently angry and ripping into each other and threatening each other, and then just promote, push, amplify, and exploit that, right? So they don't have to create the anger. They just have to use it to their advantage and push it forward. So to make us angrier against each other. And if we're fighting with each other, we're less likely to be focused on them and dealing with the issues there.
Let me ask you, it was one thing to combat that when newspapers were traditional
right.
media. Is it just infinitely more difficult to combat that given the internet today? Because it seems like the Russians are very good at this.
They're very good at it because it's the same type of thing they've been doing. They just have better weapons at their disposal with social media. They've spent a lot of time spying and understanding us and looking for our weaknesses. And they see our weaknesses politically. But they also see the technology and things we use, social media. And they immediately saw that as a weapon. They immediately saw the internet and cyber attacks as weapons. And we were slower to pick it up. You could argue that some of it was that we were so focused on terrorism, we weren't focused on these kind of lower level attacks. And also, like, you know, the FBI and others, we weren't really set up. There was no one who's supposed to be looking at this. No one's supposed to be looking at First Amendment, you know, political speech saying, hey, maybe there's something more there. Now, of course, the 2016 election and some of that has allowed us to focus on that problem. And a lot of our European allies that have been dealing with it longer and understand Russian intentions and seen some of the things that they've been doing there have helped us understand it better. So I think we're a little better. We understand it better, a little better focus, but nonetheless, it's still such a potent weapon that people around the United States often don't even realize that some of the anger and things that they're seeing may not have been created in Russia, but are showing up on their feed because the Russians are pushing it.
As a member of the clandestine feed, you probably know of efforts that we have done similar things to Russia and other adversaries. But I think for the most part, during the Cold War, we tended to use truth.
That's right. And I think
we still do that. Is that antiquated in this day and age?
Well, that's a very, very good question. But let me step back to talk about what you're talking about. So it is true after World War II, when we first created intelligence services, and we saw what Stalin and the Soviets were doing and sort of in these black arts and using these type of things. The sort of early years of the OSS and CIA, we thought we had to play that game as rough as they did. And there's things from that period of time where, you know, we were involved in overthrowing countries in Iran, and we were trying to do some of these same, you know, psychological attacks and putting false information in newspapers. And there's a number of reasons why over a few years we realized that actually we weren't, number one, we weren't very good at it. A lot of that rebounded in the wrong ways and unforeseen circumstances. And so by the 1970s, there was a lot of reform and changes in the U.S. intelligence community to say, listen, yeah, our strength is actually truth. And, you know, and we were doing some of that anyway. The intelligence community was sort of putting money in and pushing
VOA.
Sort of things. That
were,
that's right.
Right.
Yeah, Voice of America, other places. We should focus on intelligence collection. We should do these other kind of things. You know, we reserve the right to, you know, if we feel under threat, to maybe use some of these things. But we sort of moved out of that business, you know, and sort of changed the way we did things. And in recent years, you know, I worked in the CIA and I'm on Twitter and these other places, and some people will sometimes attacking, oh, you guys overthrow countries. And I'm like, if you look in the recent, you know, 30, 40 years, you can argue the United States, their military and others have tried to do other countries, but we're not doing it in sort of that underhanded secret CIA way, overthrowing countries. We're doing it quite openly, you know. And so, yeah, now what we need to start doing is, you know, the Russians never changed the way they did those things. They've continued to try to use those asymmetric and hybrid ways of doing damage and sabotage and such. Subversion is probably a better word than sabotage. And we're going to have to sort of figure out a way to deal with those things, either educating ourselves, pushing back against the Russians so that they understand there's a limit to how far they can push before there's a price for them to pay. And, you know, maybe using cyber capabilities of our own, you know, to make let them understand there's a price to be paid as well if they push too far in that area. So, I mean, it's still early days, sort of like in the early years of the Cold War, we tried to figure out nuclear deterrence and what that all meant. We need to now figure out how do we use the ability for all these countries to use these new technologies and things against us. What does that all mean? How do we respond, you know, to our best effect?
Best effect, and I think also holding up our ideals as a country.
Well, that's the thing I think that make it special. You know, I spent my years in, you know, the U.S. government's espionage service, right? My job was to go overseas, meet foreigners, find people who had access to information that the U.S. government couldn't get any other way, and essentially steal secrets. So if, you know, our diplomats and academics and business people can't figure out, you know, what the Iranian nuclear program is up to, then, you know, we need to steal it. And we need to find people that are willing to help us, to be sources for us. And it's not that we are, you know, gifted at these conspiratorial arts like some other countries. I would argue the Russians have always been, you know, big into this game, and maybe in some ways better spies than we are.
And the Chinese seem to be
fantastic. But what made us more successful, what made the CIA probably the best espionage organization in the world, is that we're Americans and we represent the United States. There's people around the world that respect the United States. They respect our openness. They respect largely what we're trying to do in the United States. And in their countries where they see corruption or they see, you know, sort of evil deeds doing, working with the United States was seen as a path that was probably better for the future of their own countries. And what I worry about in the last few years that we started to attack each other and started to move more inwardly at ourselves is, you know, we're being a little bit less and less of that vision for people of what should be right, you know. They see us, used to see us as a democratic country who had focused on human rights and all these other issues. And in recent years, you can argue we're almost ripping each other up and we're, you know, there's a chance we're becoming less democratic or less a place that the rest of the world wants to do it. So probably our ability to spy and recruit sources is harder today than it would have been 15, 20 years ago.
And this comes at a time when China is almost in a paranoid way looking for people that are those sorts of agents, you know, who are working on our behalf. They've rounded up some significant number of people recently. And I read something recently that said there was something that went out to government employees working abroad that they just had to be prepared in a new way. It wasn't necessarily the great game, but this game mentality that people approaching you out of the blue are probably working to compromise you in some way and access information. And that if you are working to do that in their country, that they're on hyper alert to nip that in the bud. Do you get that sense?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think in general, Americans are trusting people, and Americans who travel abroad, espionage and being taken advantage of in this sort of conspiratorial mindset is not something that Americans instinctively have. Where if you grew up in China or Russia, you have this automatic feeling of the state is not in your best interest, and it's best to be quiet, it's best not to speak, and you could suffer for saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing, and you're taught to be careful of the people you approach and what you say to people outside your family, et cetera. We in the United States are, you know, just the opposite. We're very open. We like people we meet. Foreigners who come here are often really surprised at how friendly Americans are and these type of things. But yeah, in this day and age, you can be taken advantage of. We all have, you know, in our pockets, computers that tie to the world that can be taken advantage of. People who travel to China and other places, their computers and their phones are going to be looked into and stolen from almost by course when you go through the airport or other places there. And so, sadly, I think we have to get a little bit more savvy and ready to deal with these things. There is a little bit of a difference in the way the Russians and Chinese do things. You know, the Russians, like I said, have been in this game for a long time and conspiratorial mindset and are using these tools against us. In a sense, they just want to do damage to us or damage to the relationship with the United States, between the United States and Europe. So almost anything that hurts the United States is in their interest. The Chinese, I think they want to control, they want to essentially replace us. They want to control the world economy. They want to be the sort of largest and most important country. They don't necessarily, but they need the United States to essentially continue to do business and be, so they're not looking to damage and bring down the United States because they sort of are intertwined with our economy. They just want to essentially become the 21st century United States.
And I think they rightly feel that they're the largest populous nation. They're really the manufacturer for the world. They should be treated with that sort of respect.
And they certainly should be treated with that respect. And I think it's going to be really important for the United States over the next 10, 20, 30 years to find a way to make that relationship as beneficial, and how to deal with China and deal with the Chinese dictatorship that are doing some things that are important for us to work with. You know, you saw, for example, on the whole climate change issue and all that kind of stuff, we need to work with the Chinese because essentially if they're not playing along, no matter what we do, it's not going to matter. But at the same time, there's some things that are, you know, incredibly inappropriate in what the Chinese are up to. So managing that relationship is going to be the challenge for the United States for the next few decades.
John Cypher, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Really great to be here, Rich. Appreciate it.
John Cypher is a 28-year veteran of the CIA National Clandestine Service and a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He was a guest speaker for the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, speaking on Putin's war against the United States. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.